go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. My book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster and quicker. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. You can simply go to Amazon.com, search The Cognitive Rampage, and you'll find the second edition there, as well as the Kindle version. The audiobook is going to be released sometime in June. Sometime in June, I will have the audiobook of the second edition available as well. My guest on the podcast today is a contributing journalist to Singularity Hub. This is going to be long, by the way. Co-founder of Café Scientifique in Dubai, co-founder of Intelligent Optimism, senior project manager at SciFest Dubai, which is a festival we're going to get into a lot in this podcast, and a developer, I like to say, business developer at SheWorks, which is actually something else I was interested in and saw as kind of activism. But SciFest Dubai is the first science festival of its kind in the city of Dubai, back when it was the first of its kind. Now it has over 300 events, 4,000 audience members, 500,000 social media followers, and it's getting bigger each day. She's the founder of that. The aim with this festival, which is what I love the most about it, it's not the boring classroom approach as it is to celebrate science through drama, poetry, music, fashion, literature, art, workshops, stage shows, debates especially. I would love that. Panel discussion, quizzes, storytelling. I love it. It's the way we learn. It's the way we learn. I appreciate you coming on the podcast, Raya. Yeah,
thanks for having me. Excited.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad we could chat. You actually came nominated by a Tribe of Change member on Facebook, Tiffany Malner.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
You all friends, I take it?
We actually haven't met, but we have a lot of mutual friends on social media. And she's a wonderful supporter of everything that we do.
Oh, that's cool. She's quite the voice in the Tribe of Change. I'm glad she connected us and got us together. And like I said, a long intro list of stuff that you do, quite the entrepreneur, developer, activist, if I had to sum up all of those projects of yours.
Right. So I'm a social entrepreneur and science journalist. And I think everything that I do comes with the idea of solving a global grand challenge and solving a world problem. And as a member of a founding member of SciFest Dubai, really the goal and the intention was, while Dubai had a lot of jazz festivals, it had a lot of different music festivals, it didn't really have much going on from the science front. And not just through festivals, we felt like there was a disengagement of the general public with advancements in science and technology, which is a general trend around the world, right? Science is often perceived as something that you do as a subject in school. It's this academic thing. Very few people engage with science and technology outside of an academic setting. And we wanted to change that, and hence SciFest Dubai. And what's what really distinguishes us as a festival is that we focus on what we call STEAM education. So you have STEM, but then you have STEAM, which is where the arts is added to STEM. And we use the arts as an excuse to kind of promote science, everything you went through, you know, like storytelling, art competitions, on exhibitions, on fashion shows, music concerts. So we create science-themed events around STEAM education. And the festival has been very successful. We've had, in the past 3 or 4 years, we've had over 300 events, over 40,000 cumulative audience members, and 500,000 followers on social media. It's been really exciting.
Well, what brought you here? What's the backstory of you that obviously you have an enthusiasm that's been built up for this? And sometimes there's a triggering moment or event or something we witnessed or went through. What do you think was your path that kind of made you this enthusiastic about wanting to promote science and the study of it through the arts?
Right. So I think as long as I can remember, I've been a voracious reader of science. I think I was in first grade when my parents got me my first encyclopedias, you know. So I've always been passionate about it myself personally. And both my co-founder, Rowan, and I, we've collaborated on many projects with, including Intelligent Optimism, Kappa Scientifique. And we felt like we'd have a lot of these conversations amongst ourselves, but there really wasn't that engagement overall, right? And one thing that I feel strongly about, and I always say, is that science and technology is something that affects every single one of our lives, right? Like, it is the reason that we can get on a plane. It's the reason we have air conditioning. It's the reason that we have vaccines. Every aspect of our lives is influenced by science and technology. And especially when you look at the disruptive trends within technology and the exponential growth that we are seeing, it's going to impact whatever industry that you're in. So whether it's fashion or healthcare or business, technology is going to have a disruptive impact on it. So in so many different ways, it's so important that we kind of realize what's going on and we educate each other and engage each other about these effects as we move forward. And that was really the motivational factor behind starting SciFest Dubai and a lot of other initiatives.
So I can see you standing there going, is nobody else reading this? Like, this is amazing. This is awesome what we're changing. And it's sad, you know, that, as you stated, it impacts so much and influences so much of our lives, almost inevitably now for our future here on out, that's where we cut in school. We cut the music, we cut the science, we cut the research, the labs, anything that freaking costs any money to allow a child to think critically, to question what is in those books and study it, we seem to be cutting first.
Exactly. And even when you look at how science is taught in school, it's really taught as a bunch of facts and figures. Right. And I actually found that all the most valuable things I learned about science, I learned on my own through like reading popular science books, to conducting scientific experiments and actually doing research. And what people don't realize, even after having gotten a scientific degree, is that science isn't just a bunch of facts and figures. It's a process. It's the most powerful tool that we have when it comes to understanding the world around us and contributing to human progress. And very few people realize this, and that's concerning.
Yeah, it's almost like our study tool to discover. And, you know, I think science, like you said, like we were describing, is here's what science is. This is chloroform. This is chlorophyll. This is this. It's just stated as fact when the basis of science to grow in any field, I don't care if it's space or geology, whatever, you have to understand it's theoretical for the most part. There are some facts that we lean toward, but it's all this theory-based approach.
Exactly. And what's important to note is that even though it's theory-based and even though it's constantly being updated with new information and new research, it's still the most powerful way of understanding the world, right? I often do end up in conversations with people where they say, yeah, but that's just a theory. Yeah, it's a theory, but it's a theory backed up by so much evidence, and it's still the best way that we have, the best method that we have when it comes to understanding the world, right? Like, and that's what science is often a process of self-correcting. So you had Isaac Newton and his way of understanding the world. Then Einstein came along and not necessarily discredited it, but added to it and provided us with a more upgraded version of gravity, for instance, right? And you constantly see that accumulation of knowledge and that upgrading of knowledge within science. And that doesn't mean that everything we knew before a certain point was absolutely incorrect and invalid. It just means that we're constantly improving our knowledge base through the scientific method.
Yeah, and I think philosophy has played, you see it emerging more too, is kind of the outer crust, the searching vehicles, if you will, for science is almost the philosophy, the theorists that are out there contemplating and wondering, and then the engineers and scientists put the methods together, the experiments together, and we test those things over and over, and that unison you do see emerging.
Absolutely. I think one of the things we always try to highlight is like the ethics and the societal implications of the hard scientific discoveries, right? So under SciFIS Dubai Bothron and I also co-founded Cafe Scientifique Dubai. This is essentially a monthly meetup and salon type event. And what we do is we get the general public together in a very casual cafe setting, and we talk about the effects of science and tech on our lives. And we usually have a meeting once a month, and the theme is always different. So we've talked in the past, we've had meetups about astronomy, neuroscience, technology. And what distinguishes us, it's not really a one-stop shop to learn about the hard scientific facts. Instead, what we say is, okay, this is what's happening. How do we think this is going to impact society? You know, what are the possible negative and positive implications of such a breakthrough? What do we want to do to prevent certain scenarios for the future of humanity? And that's the philosophical side of it, right? That's the ethical and humanities-based conversation about the implications of science on our world today. And it's a conversation that's not being had traditionally in education. In fact, one of the issues within education is that we often have isolated subjects, right? So we teach science separately, we teach philosophy separately, if we do at all, and then we teach math separately. And what we try to also do through our initiatives is kind of have an interdisciplinary approach. So we combine science with the arts, with the humanities, with the philosophy, and kind of bring everything together as a whole package.
Well, that's putting the bait out there, right? Is because if you can find the interest and lead it in and find what your interests are, you'll almost self-teach. And, you know, when I think about why I became a therapist and then kind of developed this whole theory, transrational structure behavior theory, well, I remember looking at the psychology field and it being so young and so theory based. And I thought, well, I don't have to just be a guinea pig. Like, I can add to this shit. I don't have to be Dr. Albert Ellis or these things. It was so new that I thought that, man, we can all theorize our own approach to life or how we do things and how we see science or philosophy. And I think maybe because at such a young age in science, whatever they pitch it to you is this, you have to be extremely smart. You got to know, you know, what kept me out of it was having to take statistics and shit like that, right? So they keep you out of it. And you kind of leave that alone, a lot of people do, when the idea is it's just like psychology is. It's this frontier yet to be discovered, and we don't have to just be guinea pigs in it, that we can participate in it and share.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest takeaways is that it's a way of thinking. It's a mindset of its own. So like you could take the scientific method, which is really, you know, you have a hypothesis, you could conduct an experiment with controlling the variables and test out the hypothesis, you derive results, you cross-check. You can take that process and apply it to any circumstance or any field, right? You could conduct your own personal experiment with people. Like you could be like, okay, if I do this, this is what happens, and hence I should not do it, right? It's a kind of mindset. Or you could take it to business. Like let's say you're doing a customer research survey, you could really apply the scientific method even within that kind of a politics scenario, policy scenario where you want to test out the effects of a policy. So really the scientific method is a mindset and a way of thinking that you can apply to your personal life or to any industry at all. And that's why it's so important that everyone engages with it, even if they're not officially a scientist or on the path to becoming a scientist.
Well, that's why I love the approach when I read about it is the bait, like I referred to it, is putting the poetry, the music, the storytelling, all of the different avenues that people do find that interest, and finding a way to trigger the self-teaching.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So one of the mindsets or like thought processes that we had was, let's say you're a student who really doesn't care about science, right? Like we know all the science nerds, the science geeks, they're going to come out to these events anyways, right? But if you're someone who just, you love art or you love poetry or the humanities, you're really not interested in science, by repackaging science, we can kind of make it appealing to you, right? Like if we have an astronomy arts exhibition, that we'll attract people who are interested in art, but they'll also learn something about astronomy and leave with a cosmic perspective of what it means to be human within this universe. So yeah, absolutely. That was really a thought process behind it.
Yeah, I mention a lot in a lot of my talks or podcasts. I actually shared it today on the page, but it was a TED talk by Sugata Mitria. I'm probably maybe saying it wrong, Mitra. But it was back in August 2008 where he did an experiment with kids teach themselves. Went out to rural parts. You know the study? He went out to parts of rural India, had all these setups in place to make sure, right? Okay, not too many teachers, not too well known. And he would set up these computers with the idea of they're not going to know how to run it. They'll just leave it alone, et cetera. And he would visit after certain times, and there would be 6 and 8 year olds teaching each other and running through Alta Vista and setting it up. And this I thought it was breakthrough to say that, you know, but yet we tell the kids, sit in your chair. This is a science fact. Memorize this shit and circle A, B, C, or D, and we'll see if you get to go forward. And it's almost as if I had a guy named Rafe Kelly on yesterday, and we were talking about how that education system is almost in place to either drug, chemically induce, or root out those strange off of the outliers to grow and stretch and give us new discoveries.
Absolutely. I think our entire education system has been structured to kill that kind of childlike wonder and curiosity that you have, right? We spoon feed kids with knowledge, and not just scientific knowledge, any kind of knowledge. And what I absolutely love, I've heard of that experiment before, and I love so many things about it. One, it just shows the power of technology in teaching, right? Like, because of technology, we can now make information of all kinds so accessible to everyone for free. And that can have such liberating effects on society. It can really, really have a powerful impact on developing countries, especially. Secondly, what I absolutely love about it, it just shows the importance and power of independent learning. I don't think we teach young people that. I don't think there are lots of young people now who think, I have a question, let me go find the answer, right? Like, or the process of finding the answer. Like, that requires such a specific subset of skills. Like, yes, we have a lot of information online now, but there's a lot of misinformation as well. So you, first of all, you need the critical thinking mindset to say, okay, this is a good source, this isn't. How do you validate the information? How do you not? And kind of how do you motivate yourself and stay motivated to learn without having a teacher breathing down your neck, right? So I think we've almost redefined and restructured learning as something that happens in a classroom, in a lecture setting, with a teacher that's holding you accountable, as opposed to learning being this exploratory process where you go on and find answers to questions, where you discover things. Even the question of asking a question, that itself is a skill that we need to be teaching students, right? We teach them how to answer questions, but not how to ask questions. And yeah, our entire education is in absolute need of reform, for sure.
Yeah, you bring up a good point about especially the newer generation of the idea of that they've a few people have talked about the idea of not needing to know anymore, that you essentially find it. But I think that's off halfway, because what you mentioned is having to go further, the critical thinking beyond the quick Google search. There's the fact, need to know it, but really breaking it down and allowing that self-learn. Because, I mean, I have a 17-year-old daughter, and there's not a question when it comes to certain music bands she won't be able to answer. She can answer them all. Of who's this, who's in concert, where, who came from where. And you look at when it's something they love, something they assimilate to and grow to, you go, holy shit. You know, she's still doing well in school. But the idea is, I thought about that, right? The assimilation to something. If we apply that, some people, I think I know almost every lyric to every song I've ever heard in my life. And I think, man, what a waste, how much more stuff I could know, you know. Right. But to teach that critical thinking, we, you know, knowledge is power, right? And we can't have the masses having the power.
Absolutely. I think that, we absolutely need to know how to think critically. And that's really not something we are kind of designed. Our education system has been designed to teach in any way, right? Like, I know the SAT supposedly have a critical thinking section, but studies have consistently shown that we're not really tackling critical thinking through that. And taking it back to science, like, it's so important to be able to analyze, okay, I got this result, what could be other biases and reasons that played into getting that particular result, right? And under critical thinking also comes all the being aware of all the cognitive biases we all have that lead us to think certain things. And these have widespread implications, not just on science, but also like how we participate in a democracy, the kind of consumer decisions we make. And I do believe that if we lived in a world where everyone was kind of equipped with the required critical thinking skills, we'd live in a very different world than we do today.
Oh, I would agree. And well, because you're doing work like that, there's hope for that generations to be changing that over time. And it only takes a few small seeds. And speaking of small seeds, are there certain age groups that you see adapted to certain areas of science or even cultures even that assimilate to certain parts of science? Pick that any field, right? Are there six-year-olds hanging out? I think you know what I'm asking, but I'm interested.
Well, it's interesting because at our festival, we gather a very wide range of age groups, right? We have like storytelling sessions for kids as young as 5, and we have more advanced panel discussions for adults or anyone really. And I'm kind of with Neil deGrasse Tyson on this, that the youngest people, like youngest kids often make the best scientists, right? If you look at your average toddler, they're always exploring. They're always asking questions. They're very curious. I mean, it gets annoying sometimes, but they're always like, why, how, you know? And they have this childlike sense of wonder and awe about this world that they're trying to grapple with. And I think that's almost like, that's almost a prime age to kind of cultivate that childlike sense of wonder I mentioned and ensure that it develops into something bigger instead of kind of shutting it down or kind of putting them victim to the education system and having it die off.
Yeah, I mean, to reference the Cat Stevens song, right? He was told to listen the minute he could speak. And it's that's what we do. We force, I write about it in my book too, because even in psychology, as we grow up, we begin to put periods on the world, others and self, right? And we get less curious. We just kind of go, that's it. That's the world. I get it. People suck. The world is shitty, right? And we make these concrete beliefs. And that same idea plays into our life where we quit asking ourselves, well, why do I believe that? Why am I sad? Why, you know, we lose that curiosity of the child. And it's such a important point and an era in their development to where, I mean, let the kid go, let it go, let it see what it makes, creates. And I think kids provide so much. It's just I think just in their observation, like you said, of questioning why, picking this up, smelling it, sometimes eating it, right? And touching it. But you know, there's a problem sometimes, I think, that as humans, when we get older with science, I've referenced it on a podcast before, that with science, and I'll just say side note, hydrogen bombs, et cetera, that many times we're like toddlers in the kitchen with all of the drawers open. And we're playing with the chemicals underneath it. We're twirling knives and turning on blenders and garbage disposals, you know, and we're like a toddler in there. And speak on that for a minute. You know, the idea that sometimes do we ever ask ourselves, should we go that far with science and technology?
Right. I think from my experience, the best scientists are really, they have that sense of wonder and awe and questioning. And I like how you pointed out how it's also not just within the avenue of becoming a better scientist, but also becoming a better person. You know, like, I feel like when you start asking those questions, like, why am I sad? Why is that person reacting in that way? Or why did this happen? And you almost develop better insight into human nature as well, right? Because if you're constantly asking these questions, you're constantly seeking out answers, and you're constantly becoming wiser as a human being, as opposed to kind of accepting the status quo of things just the way that they are. And I think that's what I absolutely love about it. And that kind of like childlike sense of awe is that, and questioning, is that you don't accept the status quo. All the things that we take fundamentally to just be the case, you question. Like, wait, why do we do this? Like such a basic question of why do we have money, right? Like, why do we buy things and why do we sell them? Like, what is this exchange of currency that has to be required to create value? And only a child would ask a question like that. But it's by asking questions like that that you start, that innovation begins with, right? Like, if you look at, for instance, the blockchain or alternatives to banks and traditional currencies, it always starts with someone saying, but why do we do things the way that we're doing things? Like, it's so inefficient. Like, billions of dollars are being lost every year through this system. Why not do it another way? And you can almost hear a kid say that. You can almost hear someone really young be bold enough to question something so fundamental about how we do things.
And that, I think, is what's necessary, is the questioning of the what we call fundamentals of our lives, the core beliefs of why we live it, why we do it, and bringing that emphasis out there. And, you know, it's funny, like with science or even philosophy, poetry, all the things you're talking about, everyone tends to leave sometimes their title at the door. You know, many times we're defined by what we do for a living. You know, I'm a lawyer, I'm a writer, right? But when you gather around music, poetry, art, and even science and research, no one goes like, hi, I'm a lawyer and I'm here to look at your artwork.
You know what I mean? They're like, I'm just a fan of this art. You know, I just love this movie or this play, theater, comedy, that whatever you pick. And to organize something and kind of your Trojan horse, if you will, to science for the youth, I think is highly needed.
Absolutely. Like, it's also, again, it's a very powerful technique, especially with the youth. Like you mentioned your daughter, and a lot of teenagers in that age, they're always up to date with the latest pop culture, like the music, you know, like the arts, the movies. They're totally on top of their that. So by making science cool, by bringing in that element of pop culture and music and art and repackaging that, that's another way of reaching out to the youth and saying, look, this is awesome. Like, this is just as cool as the art you listen to. Come engage with it.
Well, I think it's all connected. You know, I ponder a lot, trust me, on why my daughter wants to go to concerts all the time, right? And I think, you know, why did I, right? Why am I going to a reggae festival at this, as soon as the show's over, right? I'm doing that to escape that, I don't know, the structured idea of what I'm supposed to be or supposed to be doing. And I found it that my daughter loves to tell me the most things that I don't know or what I thought I knew. She loves to go, guess what? That's not true, right? Or guess what I learned, right? That's why I sometimes tell parents, don't give them ideas on what they could do for a future. Just let them put their own flag in. Because the minute you tell them, hey, you could try this, they go, nope, not doing that. You gave me the idea, right? And so maybe that because the education system is confined and pitches it in this fucking blacklisted, charred way of you must and memorize, and then parents are going, do this and do this and do it the way I do it, that maybe they just get trapped. And guess what? You don't know about this band. Guess what? You don't know about this person. But if we could shift, you know, have a foundation shift, like we talked about in the beginning, to where the kids can find that same escape in science, in philosophy, in psychology. And my daughter and I would chat after school sometimes for hours about philosophical randomness. And she would drop shit. And I'm going, holy shit. Like, I never looked at it like that. You know, it's like you said, that straightforward, why do we have money?
Absolutely. And I think that going back to the why people go to concerts, why do you like kids like doing these things? It's people, I think, inherently seek out immersive experiences, right? Mm-hmm. We seek out experiences that are awe-inspiring, that captivate us, that grip us. And I think that often science and even education have failed to provide that. That kind of an immersive, awe-inspiring, captivating experience. Like, learning isn't defined to be that. Doing science or learning about science is often not defined in such a way. And it's important to transform that because, like you said, think of how powerful it would be if like our resources, our passion, our time and energy was spent kind of being immersed in that. Instead of being immersed into superficial, sometimes amazing concerts, but often superficial music or pop culture that we have today.
Yeah, I knew this guy who didn't come to school much, avoided it when he could. But the one day he'd always be there would be on field trip day. And when it was field trip time, I don't care what grade it was in, this kid always showed up for field trip, in particular the science museum when it was time to go there. That kid was myself. But anytime, you know, it seems like when field trips are in place, right, to immerse yourself, those are the most memorable, right? They create the experience. I was there. I was in it. Like I'll never forget when a professor took us. He was a medieval specialist who specialized in cultural execution devices. And Dr. George Brooks, shout out to you, who's been on the podcast as well, took us to this medieval place and was walking us through the village, and dude could just get detailed into like where this came from and that. And I'll never forget that shit. You know what I mean? I'll never forget the immersion like that. And that, I think that's so key, and we don't do that anymore.
Exactly. And it's so sad that often for a lot of people, the memorable experiences of high school were outside of the classroom, right? They were the extra activities that you did. They were the extra field trips that you did. Those were more exciting and unpredictable. And I do think there are positive trends within technology that can provide those immersive experiences even more easily. Like, you have virtual reality that's becoming a huge trend. A lot of big companies like Oculus as well, they're kind of developing educational programs that you could do with VR. And essentially what they allow is they allow a teacher to take a classroom full of students on a journey, whether it's through space or through the pyramids in Egypt or whatever it is. And even if it's just like getting that immersive experiences and transcending beyond the physical location, the physical boundaries of the classroom. And yeah, I do think that more teachers and more educators need to aspire to give their students those immersive experiences. And you can do that even without VR and even without technology.
Yeah, and you know, I was telling my daughter, you can do it yourself. Call up a company or a field you're interested in and just go, hey, can I watch you guys on Mondays for a couple hours? You know, immerse yourself into it and become a part of it by observing.
Exactly. In fact, a few friends of mine would always talk about this. Like, think about how much more impactful a university education would be if instead of paying the institution, you paid a company and you said, look, I will come and work for you for 3 years and I will learn and get experience and read whatever you assign to me. Like, you would develop so many more valuable skill sets than you would if you were sitting in a classroom for 3 or 4 years and just consuming information nonstop.
Holy shit. Oh, actually, I really like that idea. I mean, because it's supposed to be these colleges that are coming out with the new research and the grants and all this stuff. But I mean, let's be honest, some of the peer reviewed, if you will, has been lobbyist influenced many times. And it's hard to even trust a lot of the research that comes out of those astute schools, if you will. But that's a brilliant idea. I like it. I'm sure the corporation would take a $30,000 loan or something from the government to train somebody early. That's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, let's just hope either someone does it, right?
Yeah, someone will do it first. It'll come. You being actually on the forefront, if you will. I mean, you're literally, you know, out there looking beyond of what's coming. Technology speaking, what are some major influences you see over the next 5 years developing and truly having an impact, like a more than now or something that's not on the grid yet?
Right. I think there's so many different trends. Like if you look at the future of any industry, like the future of work, the future of education, the future of healthcare, like every single sector is being disrupted. I think what really, like within the context of education, we should be talking about is like the future of work and how that's being radically shifted. Like one thing that I feel like not a lot of people are aware of is the rise of the contingent workforce. And what we're seeing more and more, both in terms of preference of the millennials that are coming in the workforce and the employers that are hiring them, is that we're seeing a greater number of remote workers, right? So thanks to technology, what we're seeing is more freelance work, more independent contractors, and even full-time hirees that are actually working from across the planet remotely. And because of technology, we now can do that. But that also means it's complete adaptation in terms of what we teach our kids, right? Like they need to be adapted to be able to work on full-time, like on a project basis as opposed to field basis. Or they need to learn how to communicate digitally and network digitally and lead by influence in the digital world, because often they'll be communicating with a team where the individual team members are all across the planet. So it's not your traditional meeting or traditional office where you go in and someone gives you instructions. So, and then you have the rise of like technological automation with AI. So a lot of the monotonous tasks, the everyday tasks are being automated with artificial intelligence. And instead of requiring those administrative skills or day-to-day monotonous skills, what we require is problem solving, critical thinking, imagination, communication. So these are the soft skills that are really going to be crucial in the workforce in the future. And so that immediately has an influence on the future of education as well. And what I think that these advances within the workforce are happening so quickly and education is just not keeping up with it. I think a lot of educators are not really aware of all these different trends like technological automation, the rise of the contingent workforce. They're completely transforming the kind of skill sets we'll need, the kind of talent that we'll need, the kind of mindsets that we'll need. And there needs to be more conversation and awareness and transformation within the system to adapt to that.
Yeah. So that word search crossword puzzle thing they gave you in 10th grade on Thursdays, that little quiz that followed, probably not going to help me too much.
Right. No, probably not going to help you too much.
Yeah. We laugh at it now, but the truth is, right, it's detrimental, like you said, is what happens when truck drivers are automated? What happens when food service is automated, when waiters and waitresses are no longer needed? I mean, you already see the cashiers leaving the stores. I mean, you're seeing all that go away and you don't see the education system training that. You're still trained to go to a vo-tech school or, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Even if you look at like technical skills or skills within finance and banking, a lot of those sectors too are becoming automated. And what we're seeing is that the trend is that the skills that will be required are really the higher ordered problem solving, critical thinking, communication skills, you know, and like emotional intelligence, like interacting with other human beings. Because anything that really involves a pretty routine task, whether it's on a computer or whether it's at a cashier, can be automated. What can be automated will be automated because it's cheaper. Like it's in the best interest of any corporation or company to get that AI investment and to automate those systems. And I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages to that. Obviously, a huge thing that we have to all grapple with is that where will all the jobs go? What are we going to do? We're going to need universal basic income. That's like a whole different discussion. But on the other hand, the cost of products come down too, because this technology that's being automated is on an exponential trend. It's getting cheaper and cheaper. It costs less to maintain than a human being. So you would have like the cost of products go down and we can access things for much cheaper. But very few people are even aware of these trends, let alone what they should do about them to begin with.
Yeah, shit, they got an automated Facebook therapist. You know what I mean? So they're automating this. You're text messaging with a psychologist. You know what I mean? Exactly. It's transforming the way that we even do those jobs of connecting.
Definitely. Yeah. Chatbots are huge now. And in fact, another disruptive trend, like we're seeing them in customer service. Often when you get it, like that chatbot that pops up saying, hi, I'm a client at this company. Can I help you? And more often than not, you're communicating with a robot.
Holy shit. We're
also seeing a rise of virtual assistants. A lot of really cool startups right now are kind of bringing virtual assistants, making them super cheap. And I've used some of these things and it's amazing. You just talk to them and you say, hey, can you schedule a call with this person? Use their email. They already have access to your calendar, obviously, and they just do the emailing themselves. It's absolutely mind-blowing. The potential.
Well, Go ahead. Sorry.
No. That's the point. Like, it's mind-blowing how much potential this has.
Yeah. Well, it's getting so much now that people advertise when they say, talk to a real human being when you call. You know what I mean? They even advertise it now that it's becoming less and less and going away. And it's hard not to think for myself, moving the chess pieces. I don't care, 40 years, 10 years, I don't know the number, but at least philosophically moving the chess pieces, the idea of a global income. An idea of, you know, when no one needs to be doing any work. Now this is going to be hard. Most people can't fathom even the idea of not having a leader or a president, but the idea of trying to fathom that you don't have to go to work, that you can create, you can do art, you can follow that, have fun, be family, enjoy, explore. They can't really compute that shit, that the idea that we just hand you a universal income.
Yeah. And often there are lots of counter arguments to universal basic income that go like, our economic system has just not been designed to facilitate something like that. Like, who are we going to tax? Or like all these excuses, how the current economic system and the rules and the laws and the policies that we operate within do not allow for universal basic income. And my response to that often is, then we're going to have to change the system completely. Like, the bottom line is we're going to need it eventually. And there actually have been a lot of small pocket experiments around the world to kind of test this idea of universal basic income. So there's one charity called Give Directly, and I believe they tested it in Kenya. So all they did was they just gave out free money. They had a select cohort of individuals, and they just gave them free money. And often we assume that, you know, the poor will use their money on drugs or like it's not a good idea. You have to do your research and hold them accountable or just like interview them before you give someone free money. And what they found was that for the most part, people are responsible how they use their money. And if anything, it's the most powerful way to tackle poverty, right? Like there was a similar experiment done in London I believe they took 11 homeless people and they gave them a couple of £1,000. And by the end of, I believe, a year or two after that, 11 out of the 13 homeless individuals were off the streets. They were now functioning individuals within society. They had used that money to invest in themselves, take classes, find a job, get a roof over their head, and they were doing really well. And as a consequence of that, they saved the government a lot of money because it costs taxpayers money to maintain homeless individuals within the street. So those are just like one or two examples of times that they've actually tried a version of universal basic income and seen success in terms of quality of life, in terms of reduction of healthcare costs on the state, in terms of increased safety and security for everyone. And I believe there's another experiment here in Canada that's going to be conducted soon. If I'm not wrong, the state of Ontario is going to try to universal basic income with a couple of thousand citizens. And we need more of these experiments, right, to kind of understand what works, what doesn't work, test it out. And so far, results have been very positive. But ultimately, with it's one way to tackle poverty. That's one massive motivational factor. You tackle poverty and kind of close down wealth inequality. But at the same time, we might eventually need it, whether or not poverty is a motivational factor. Because with the technological automation that we're seeing with AI, there's probably going to be a time a few decades down the road where we're going to need universal basic income in order to maintain our society, in order to keep everyone happy. And if you think about that, I think that's actually very exciting, like what the picture that you just painted, right? Like imagine you didn't have to worry about the basics, right? It's what we call cognitive bandwidth. Imagine your cognitive bandwidth wasn't wasted on making sure you can pay off bills every month, having a roof over your head, or, you know, like making sure you can afford healthcare. Instead, you all of that is covered. So you can now focus on big picture stuff. You can focus on how you can grow as a person, how you can contribute to humanity, on your creative endeavors. And that's really exciting. And that's the kind of world I know I want to live in. So like we have to kind of think about how we would design an alternative economic system that can facilitate and cater to universal basic income.
Yeah, I would bring in the idea of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that when those basics are met, the safety, shelter, and the food, when these are met, it's amazing what the human species will do for others, for mankind, for future, for themselves. NPR even did a story similar to rather than give money to these charities that gets filtered through to pay salaries, et cetera, they literally just went down, instead of even building schools, because that always sounds good too, we're building schools, and they followed the whole experiment. By the time they built the school, the money was being used elsewhere, it was corrupted places, the school was gone. Then they came back and then just gave cash to everybody in the village, and it prospered, and it worked. And I can already hear people now going, oh, you can't enable people like that and just give them. They got to work. People got to work. That's what they got to do. And I think we're shifting from the people have to create and help, not necessarily people just have to work.
Absolutely. And the bottom line is no one chooses to be poor, right? Like if you like look at case studies and like statistics about why people are poor, and often it's a lot of circumstantial stuff. Like you happen to be born in a bad neighborhood, poor family. It's hard to get the resources that you need to kind of break out of the poverty cycle, right? It's not like anyone chooses to live that kind of a life, and they can work and work and work on a job that barely pays minimum wage. They'll never develop. They've never had the time, the energy to really develop skills that can allow them to kind of break beyond that. But if let's say you cover their bills and you cover their basic needs for a year or two, where they can actually focus on taking a risk, like taking another job or discovering more things about themselves or financing their education, then they can break out from that, right? What these experiments, which ultimately use the scientific method to really understand universal basic income's effect on society, show that like people who come from poor backgrounds or low income backgrounds don't necessarily make worse decisions. What we do see is that they don't have the cognitive bandwidth to think, how can I improve? How can I grow? How can I get a better job? Because they're so focused on staying alive and making sure they don't drown under bills and keep making sure they have a roof over their head. So when that's the kind of things you're thinking about on a day-to-day basis, and you can't really think about anything beyond that. And it's quite a almost ignorant way of assuming that they're not working hard enough. And a lot of people from low-income backgrounds work even harder than your average person who's a consultant or who's a entrepreneur, right? It's just that the jobs aren't necessarily there for them, and they're in this vicious cycle of poverty that they can't break out of.
Yeah, I can hear them now. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps and do like I did, right, and make yourself better. And anytime I hear that, I've actually made this argument back when I talk about free college and everyone argues to me, I paid for my college and my, you know, I go, well, then do you ever tell yourself that you wish your kid could be better than you and have it better? Well, yeah, that's why I worked so hard and took on debt. So why the hell, if you want them to be better than you, would you want them to go through the same shit you went through? Because you're going to make another you. You're going to make the same damn thing. So as you sit here and go, no, I learned to pay for school. I worked 17,000 jobs and I did this. I don't know why he's got a country accent, but he does. And I worked 17,000 jobs and I did it this way. And so that same pain, I want to pass on to my boy, right? And he'll learn and then he'll be as good as me. But yet on the outskirts, I'll say, I just want to give them a better life than I had and make them better than me. And to do so, we have to question the process and the system to which we were currently brought in. And so when I hear free college, it's not just I'm going, fuck yeah, because they still got to make the grade and then they're still got to follow and they'll follow their own interests. They don't feel obligated. They'll take more chances. Exactly. It's that same way of changing the economic system, of questioning that. Because if I want it to be, I don't want my daughter to be fucking like me. She's already better than me. For the love of God, make it better. So don't do it like me. You know, I tell her, fucking don't go to college. I don't give a shit. Just follow what's happy, change, help people, be involved in that. And I think it's so hard for humanity as a whole, for people that have been through it, not to just want to pass on the same ideals.
Exactly. And I think that the point that's so important to me that you just made is, you know, about improvement. And I think that what we need to be able to do is imagine a world that's much better, even if it sounds like a utopia, even if it sounds completely impractical, and kind of reach out for that, right? I think a lot of people, like one of the things that we always advocate for is this mindset of intelligent optimism. And it's being optimistic about the future in a rational way, like looking at all the scientific evidence, looking at everything that we have accomplished as humanity, as a human species, and saying, we can do even better because we've done so many things before. And yeah, no, I think these concepts like universal basic income, free college, you know, like AI, like all the futuristic transhumanist mindsets almost, to a lot of people sounds impractical and like a complete utopia, but it's not prevented by the laws of physics, right? Like if you think of what the word impossible really means, there's no reason why we can't aspire to that. And there's no reason why we can't make this exciting, amazing future a reality.
Yeah, there's, I think science also gets lost in, or loses, if you will, like we talked in the beginning, it's open mysticism. It's open idea of what it could be, of the questioning of it, and becomes down and boiled down to these boring facts of this is how it is, this is what it is. And it keeps so many people away from it, I think. And I was almost imagining SciFest, right, 25 years from now, right? The things that you're seeing at your festival, that some things you've talked about now and the experiments and applying that scientific method in so many areas of life. I mean, what's SciFest look like, let's say 50 years from now, compared to what you're seeing now?
That's an exciting question to think about. I think a lot of it will stay the same and a lot of it will change. I think one thing that will always be important is the importance of amazing content and amazing people, right? So you can have a virtual reality set, but without the right educational program to run on it, it's going to be useless, right? So I think that it's the same with almost at the festival. We're still going to need these amazing minds to kind of bring wonderful, inspiring, interdisciplinary content with whatever tool that we end up presenting the content with. And I do see it growing. I do see it becoming international. And even more, I do see us integrating a lot of these disruptive trends like AI, VR, and kind of using that to promote science as well, and having attendees engage with those disruptive trends. And I think that I do also want to see that happening within all of science and the entire field as a whole. Like one of the things you mentioned earlier just now was that, you know, science is just packaged as this boring, intimidating thing almost. And if you look at how scientific papers are written and presented, there is no better example of where the problem lies. Like, you can have the most fascinating study with mind-blowing findings and have it presented as an academic scientific paper and bore someone to death, right? And that's coming from me, who actually loves science, and I can't make it through one of these papers. And in fact, there is an alternative trend to that called Dance Your PhD, where professors are encouraged to kind of perform their thesis or perform their results in an exciting, like, interactive way, as opposed to presenting it as an academic paper. But yeah, no, I do hope that, I mean, I do see SciFest Dubai having that kind of an influence across the scientific industry and field, and kind of inspiring more alternative ways of communicating science and engaging with the general public.
Well, the methods you're using to help deliver it and bring those in are arts that we've had since our conception, really, of consciousness, of art and poetry and music. And I could be wrong. If someone wants to scientifically check my facts, I'd appreciate it. It seems to be a, you mentioned it earlier, just in business, right? People are traveling less. They're not traveling for meetings. You're not seeing people go on to on-site meetings. This is a trend, is those less smaller gatherings. You see people like Tim Ferriss saying less meetings is better, you know, stop meeting, et cetera, optimizing your time and all this other thing, travel, all this. But what I see on the rise is a gathering of large events, of tribal thinkers that are gathering at larger events like music festivals, right? You're seeing the rise of the AK Burning Mans, if you will, all around the world types, whether it's music festivals, psi festivals, philosophy festivals. We're doing a tribal retreat for the Tribe of Change on Facebook sometime. But you're seeing, like, I think, an emergence of larger gatherings of like minds as opposed to these smaller, tiny, unnecessary, unoptimized meetings.
Definitely. And I think the interconnected world that we live in definitely facilitates that. Like, thanks to the rise of social media, like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, we can now easily connect with these tribes from around the world. We can connect and stay in touch with individuals from anywhere in the world. Like, now we all have friends in so many different countries. We're way beyond becoming like global citizens, if you can say. So I think absolutely, I think that's the trend. I think what we're also seeing is those digital meetups coming together. Like the Facebook group that you just described, I'm sure has individuals from all around the world participating. And people often say things like, yeah, thanks to social media, our millennials are far less social than they are. They don't know how to socialize. But I think it's the opposite. I think we're socializing differently, but we're socializing even more because now we have more tools and more people at our fingertips. Like, I can go on LinkedIn and search for anyone anywhere in the world and any company, find them and connect with them. Like, if I'm interested, let's say if I want to find another fellow burner, I would go on whatever social media platform, find a Burning Man group, and immediately, that's it. It takes me a few minutes to connect with thousands of people from around the world. And we take that for granted. Like, we don't really take this moment to step back and kind of realize how amazing that is because it's so integrated into our lives and we're so used to doing it every day. But it's really mind-blowing if you think about it.
Well, people knock, I think, what they don't understand. You see a lot of the older generation definitely accusing the millennials, you know, you're going to have no social skills, et cetera. Well, in my era, I was going to go blind and have no social skills because I played Tecmo Bowl too much. And I was watching The Simpsons and Beavis and Butthead. So I was just going to be a moron. And here I am socializing with people all over the world, 10 times smarter than me. And I thrive on that connection. And I think as we get older and it changes, that generation tends to go, I don't understand you staring at that screen. And so we make an unscientific hypothesis and go, that means you're not going to be able to talk to people anymore. And I can tell you when I meet older generations, they don't like to talk much anyway. And I'm generalizing, but they don't trust anybody anyway. They're walking around going, I don't trust you. You know, they don't want to talk to you, protecting. I'm being very general, people. Please don't email me.
Right.
I'm pointing out the fact that if you find yourself making fun of it, you may not understand it. And especially check your hypothesis.
Absolutely. You want to test it scientifically and control for all the variables before you jump to a conclusion.
Said much better by a scientist, right? Can you repeat that? Can you say that again?
Oh, gosh. You want to test your hypotheses and control for all the variables before you jump to conclusions.
Good God.
Retest it and have someone else clarify the methodology. So there we go.
Thank you. And do that, everyone, in your world and your mind and psychology all the time. You'll come back on again. I love this. I felt like we didn't even really get to go further in some other topics that...
This was amazing. And I absolutely love your podcast. And I'd be happy to be back on and talk some more.
Oh, I appreciate it. I think a few people listen. I love them for it, but I've been doing it a while. But it's festivals like you. It's the technology. That's the stuff I love to learn about. When's the next festival?
It's November 1 to 7, 1st to 7th this year. 2017 is a citywide festival. We have multiple venues. You can find more information at scifestdubai.com.
Yeah, have you done that before? Have you done the promotion? Follow us, subscribe to us, find us.
Yes, I have. And you can find us on Facebook as well.
Yeah, definitely look them up. So in November, maybe after the SciFest, come on, tell us how it went, you know, share some cool things that went on. Yeah, I'd love to hear about it.
I'd love to.
Yeah, I don't think I'll find myself in Dubai. I'm still on this walkabout in the desert out here, finding love and my spirit out here. I don't know, but Dubai is a little ways away, but I love the choice of area because it's kind of known as that techie place. They even have like the science park that they put together.
Yeah, they're putting that together. You can find the first 3D printed office in Dubai. There's a museum of the future in the works. So a lot of exciting things happening in the city.
Perfect place to choose, I think, to have that festival. And maybe I'll make it out there because apparently they're going to be going over the next 50 years or so. So
yeah, we'd love to have you.
It'll be fun. And thank you for all your work. I appreciate you coming on. I look forward to chatting sometime after November.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
For sure. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Those are the podcasts I love. The enthusiasm just oozes out, right? I love talking to people that are doing what they're passionate about, what they're enthusiastic about, more importantly, and that helps other people. If you could not see that in Rhea, you weren't watching. You could hear it definitely in her speech about wanting to change the education system. I could almost envision, I've been there before when I was coming out of psychology, I could see her like going, open the present. Don't you see it? Just would you open it, right? And just wanting to bring that to the world, bring that curiosity back. I urge you to do that, is bring back your curiosity for the world, for others, for self, for your passions, for old friends, new friends. Open up that curiosity. Remember what it's like to be a kid, even if you can't remember it. If you can't remember it, look at your child. Look at another kid who's just spinning around in the park going, for no reason, right? Look how much they're in the present, how much they're questioning and exploring. You are not fucking dead. You are not. It's not over. You haven't chosen the life. It's not it. It's not what it's all about. There's so much to be explored. This world, your life, your conscious, your subconscious, that is your Disney world. That is your park to play in and discover and share. Share your experiences. Connect with other people. You're not alone out there. Find that curiosity again. Question it. Add to humanity. Think about humanity and push it forward. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage.
Love you.